Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray and this week it is the last in the series, so we've gone all out with a bumper triple bill special episode. We will be talking to Richard Brooks about Mr. Ehud Shelag, the mysterious man at the top of the Conservative Party who has some fascinating connections overseas. We'll be talking to Tim Minogue about how cash-strapped councils are resorting to all kinds of business ventures without much experience of it and generally coming a cropper. And we'll be talking to Heather Mills and to the magazine's editor, Ian Hislop, about banging on, about why it's so important to keep covering stories, sometimes for 10 or 20 years, and about what happens when you do. But first, Mr. Ehud Shelag, the man who is the treasurer of the Conservative Party. In the last issue of Private Eye, he was the subject of a special investigation by Richard Brooks, one of the Eye's investigative team. And the investigation has turned up some absolutely fascinating stories which deal with overseas accounts and extremely expensive artworks. So I thought it was time to get Richard in for a conversation about the mysterious Mr. Shelag. And I started off by asking him what the principal duty of a Tory party treasurer is anyway.
To fund the campaigns, the elections, one of which might come sooner rather than later. And, of course, to check that that money is the right sort of money. Mm. That's a crucial part of it. You know, we've had so many scandals over the years involving nefarious funds coming into, well, not just the Conservative Party, but other parties. And they're there to make sure that we get well-funded, clean politics.
And we've written about Ehud Shelag before. You've written about Ehud Shelag before. Can we just describe his kind of prehistory in the Eye before this special piece that you've written for this issue?
Well, we first raised a few questions about Mr. Shelag back in October after the Telegraph had done a big puff piece on him saying, you know, how this man had come from nowhere to the heights of the Tory party. So we had a look at where his money had come from. That was the most important aspect, because he'd got the treasurer job on the back of donations of nearly £2 million in the space of around 18 months.
That's very unusual, surely. Even for the biggest donors,
that's a huge amount. That's more than, you know, hedge fund managers who are worth tens of millions, possibly hundreds of millions, give to the party. It's a massive, massive donation. And it was kind of out of nowhere. It was the first, or that 1.9 million or so, was the first money that Mr. Shelag had given to the party, okay, despite having been in the UK since the start of the 1990s.
Okay, so he fell hard for the Conservative Party and thought, I must start funding these people.
That's right. I mentioned that he was an art dealer. He has a gallery on Bond Street. Now, this gallery that he co-owns with a chap called Paul Green, that had given about £100,000 before, back in David Cameron's early days. It had hosted a lunch for David Cameron and Boris Johnson. They all went to this gallery, this kind of flagship gallery on Bond Street, which is a very glamorous location, and had lunch with donors and tapped them up for a few quid. I think it was about £5,000 a seat.
Okay.
So there was that connection. Mm. But then there was a fairly barren period for about 5 years when Halcyon and Shelag didn't give anything. And then Ehud Shelag weighed in with this couple of million.
And the times that we'd written about him before, it was about his connections to offshore money, which listeners of this podcast will know we cover quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, the world of offshore finance has been a bit of a theme in the Eye, among other places, but also a theme for the government, who, for the last decade, really, since David Cameron's early days, have been promising to clamp down on offshore finance and introduced some measures to deal with that. So there's a certain irony in their party treasurer funding his business and his donations to the Tory party indirectly from a family trust that's based offshore, that owns the art gallery through British Virgin Islands Company, and an Isle of Man nominee company, a string of offshore companies.
So the gallery, which is co-owned by Mr. Schellegg, who's a Tory party treasurer, that gallery is co-owned by him through a Virgin Islands company.
That's right. Mr. Schellegg himself is a UK resident, UK tax resident, so his personal income is presumably taxed in the UK, and therefore he's legitimately giving money to the Conservative Party. But the whole family wealth is owned offshore, and it's that offshore structure that owns half the this gallery on Bond Street, among other businesses.
And Halcyon started as a relatively minor gallery. I don't think that's too unkind to say. It was in Birmingham's New Street, and Paul Green, the co-owner with Mr. Schellegg, was a local art dealer. And then suddenly has risen up and up to become incredibly successful.
Yeah, the circumstances in which Green and Schellegg got together are a bit mysterious. Even in this adulatory Telegraph profile, all they'll say is that they were dancing around together for a little while before finally becoming business partners. So it's not quite clear what was behind it. But Paul Green, his family had a gallery in Birmingham. Mr. Schellegg then joined at the end of the 1990s. They started expanding in Mayfair, opened an outlet in Harrods, which is still there. So really, they went big time at that point.
As you say in this piece, by 2017, the Halcyon Gallery was London's top-earning gallery, which had £88.5 million of income during that year. So this is a huge gallery.
Yeah.
Now, is that just, you know, people paying too much for art? And we know the art world is full of hype.
Yeah. Well, this is a particularly hypey part of the art world. The Halcyon model is to promote a stable of artists, many of whom are not considered by the art world or the art establishment to be all that fantastic. One critic said that Halcyon was purveying London's tawdriest art. It's all a bit, to aficionados, it's all a bit obvious and a bit tacky what they do. But they also specialise in some big names. One of their main business lines is Warhol prints.
Okay.
Because there are quite a few of those knocking around. They pick them up at gallery at auctions and other places, and then stick a nice frame on them and sell them for perhaps double their value.
So is there anything especially wrong with that? Because we know that the art world is full of fools and their money being parted very deftly.
Well, yeah, you could say that they have these big windows and they see the customers coming a mile off and help them spend their money. Some very rich people, and a lot of this art, like Warhol prints, is very appealing. But where I think there is a problem is that they present what they do as helping people make investments, and they claim that what they're selling them will retain its value or even increase in value, when actually at the moment they buy the piece, they're likely to have something worth a lot less than they pay for it.
It's like buying a diamond. Which often loses its value as soon as you walk out of the shop.
Yeah, but the question is how much? I mean, you can expect a certain amount of that, but not 50%. And a number of people I spoke to when researching this told me that Halcyon was at the very aggressive end of the art market in doing that. So I think that's a bit of a problem anyway, but you know, how much of a story would art gallery rips off rich people be? Well, maybe that wouldn't be one for the pages of Private Eye, unless the man running it was treasurer of the Tory party.
And this is where we come on to Halcyon's overseas operations.
Yeah, now, the overseas operations are a bit of a mystery. Halcyon has had companies operating in Singapore and Hong Kong without actually having any physical business there. It's since opened a gallery in Shanghai, but for a number of years it was running companies in Singapore and Hong Kong, which were buying and selling art from the UK companies, it appears, for delivery to overseas customers. And I looked into those companies and found some very strange features. For a number of years, Halcyon Gallery in the UK was claiming to buy tens of millions of pounds worth of art every year from the Singapore company, Halcyon Singapore. Yet when you looked at the Singapore company's accounts, there was no sign of those sales. They showed, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of sales, nowhere near what Halcyon in the UK said it was buying from that very company. Now, that begins to look extremely odd for all sorts of reasons, which could be tax reasons, for example. And I asked Halcyon about this, and they won't explain it, which, you know, raises even more questions. They've told me there aren't actually any discrepancies. Well, there are. And they won't say, you know, how the different numbers are explained.
So just to give the exact figures for that, in the 2 years from May 2011 to April 2013... the Halcyon Gallery in the UK bought £27 million worth of art from the Singapore company, and yet over the calendar years, so over a slightly longer period spanning that period, the Singapore company reported that it just had £5.3 million.
Yeah.
So there's nearly £22 million there of difference.
Yeah, and there was an even bigger difference in other years. So and they also claimed that their accounts were all audited, when that wasn't true. The Singapore accounts aren't audited. So, you know, there is an unexplained financial hole, which is not something you want from a Tory party treasurer.
No. So are there other parts of international business that Halcyon's doing that raise any questions for you?
Well, I began to question exactly who they're doing their business with. In recent years, the turnover of the gallery has gone up dramatically. So where's the money coming from? And it seems that for the last 10, 12 years or so, the big focus has been on overseas sales, targeting money in Russia and the former Soviet countries, and more recently China. And if you're going to target those sort of places to earn money, that's not illegitimate itself, but you have to be careful. And I think there are some big questions about whether Mr. Schellig has been careful enough.
So what examples have you described in the piece that's in the mag?
It seems that Mr. Schellig and Halcyon have got very close to some figures who don't have the best of reputations, let's say. One of Halcyon's most important artists is a Siberian sculptor called Dashi Namdakov, who seems to be used to cultivate a big client base in Russia. Halcyon have boasted that Vladimir Putin owns one of his pieces,
okay,
among other big figures. And we know that Udi Schellig went over to Moscow in 2009. And we know that one of his major customers, one of the people who is schmoozed at the regular events they host with the royal family, is a woman called Yelena Batarina, who is the wife of the mayor of Moscow until 2010. A chap called Yuri Lushkov presided over a very corrupt Moscow administration. Now, we don't know whether Mr. Schellig met these people over there, but his wife became a very good customer. She's accused of making her money from corrupt contracts awarded by the Moscow administration run by her husband. So these are maybe not the circles you want to be moving in. And perhaps, you know, in that context, even more troubling is that Mr. Schellig continued to cultivate the Russian establishment after we had imposed sanctions following the annexation of Crimea by Putin.
This is someone who was just a couple of years off becoming the Conservative Party treasurer.
Yes, that's right. Was regularly hosting the royal family through events at Buckingham Palace, a big supporter of the Duke of Edinburgh's International Foundation. He invited Prince Harry and Prince William to play for his polo team at an annual match they have. They did indeed play, which of course pulled in plenty of, you know, wide-eyed punters.
And there were other connections, weren't there, to figures who you might want to do quite careful due diligence on before doing business with them?
Yes, in 2015, at the same time as the Russian ambassador was unveiling this statue, the Halcyon Gallery was also setting up a really big deal with a really suspicious character from Russia, specifically from Tatarstan, you know, not the most reputable of republics in Russia, Halcyon granted a franchise of their gallery to a chap called Rustam Magdeyev, who has been linked on many occasions with organized crime groups in Russia. The deal was that his company could use the Halcyon name, set up a Halcyon gallery, and would buy a lot of artwork from Halcyon. Now, of course, the question that prompts is, where did his money come from to buy all this artwork? So at the same time that Halcyon gave a franchise to Rustam Magdeyev's company in Cyprus, Graff Diamonds, the well-known British diamond company, also gave a franchise to open an outlet right next door to Halcyon in Limassol Marina. Now, that diamond deal has turned very sour indeed. Well, as has the art deal. The gallery is now shut down because Rustam Magdeyev's business partner, his co-investor in the company he was using in Cyprus, claims that Rustam Magdeyev has welched on the deal they had, and there are claims flying between the two of them. One claim is that Magdeyev seized a load of diamonds from the diamond store and sent them to Geneva, Freeport, stashed them away. Now, the Cyprus authorities are onto that. They've put a freezing order on those diamonds. But these are the kind of characters you're dealing with. But the point is, there are allegations that the money that went into the Graff Diamond business was not entirely clean, that it was the president of Tatarstan's illicit wealth.
And so there must also be questions raised about the money that Magdeyev put into the Halcyon artworks.
Yeah, given that that deal was done alongside the diamond deal and on very similar terms.
And so just to reiterate, this is the treasurer of the Conservative Party we're talking about, who is
I mean, of course, he wasn't at the time, but it wasn't too long before. This is in 2015.
So why do you think Schelling has suddenly developed this interest in Conservative Party politics?
Well, Mr. Schelling doesn't say very much publicly, but what he has said is that he saw the Tory parties as the sort of sensible option. One of the concerns was anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, and I think he sees Jeremy Corbyn as a threat. But, of course, there are lots of other things going on as well. The big issue is Brexit. I mean, it's hard to think that anybody weighs into British politics at the moment without thinking about Brexit. Around the time of his first donations, Theresa May had just published her manifesto for the general election in June 2017, which committed her to a pretty hard Brexit. Now, it's impossible to say what influence donors have, future treasurers have, or what they would prefer, or what the people giving them money would prefer. But, you know, there is an interest from places like Russia in a very disruptive Brexit. And we know this is where a lot of his money has just come from. Now, we have no evidence to suggest that there's anything improper going on in that respect. But there's clearly a huge amount of money coming from somewhere, and not just from the Halcyon Gallery. In 2013, the family trust put £16 million into the Halcyon Gallery business. More recently, it's put $10 million into an Israeli electric aircraft company. That's a fairly speculative venture. So there's clearly a lot of money coming from somewhere, and the money taken out from Halcyon Gallery doesn't appear sufficient for all this investment. Now, I've asked Halcyon where it's come from to explain the source of the funds, and they just say that well, there's a family trust, and the rest isn't really your business.
But it is obviously the business of the Conservative Party.
I think it is our business, because being treasurer of the governing party in Britain is quite an important job, and we need to know where your money's coming from. And indeed, a few months ago, Mr. Schelling himself seemed to agree with that. Back in August, he told the Daily Telegraph that, you know, he knew scrutiny would come with the job. He said, "I'm very open for investigations, for exposure. I welcome it. I think it's a vital part of our democracy." Well, he seems a bit less keen now.
Richard Brooks there. And Mr. Schelleg, if you are listening, there is always going to be a space for you on page 94. Do just ring up the front office and we'll manage to make room for an interview somewhere in our next series. Now, we turn to local government. And recently, Private Eye has been covering a curious trend in local government, which is that councils have started being entrepreneurs. This is a very curious thing, partly because a lot of councils are not run by business people. And as a result, a lot of the decisions or investments that they've made have started to go rather badly wrong. So I asked Tim Minogue, who writes the magazine's Rotten Boroughs page, why councils have started doing this in the first place. Here he is.
As we know, it's not a secret, all local councils are terribly strapped for cash. 8 out of 10 senior council officers think that the current system of council funding is unsustainable. Most of the coverage surrounding their attempts to save money is about raising council tax, cutting services, or selling off property and other things. And according to that survey, 57% of councils are still keen to sell assets. And the story we don't hear so much about is their attempts to make some money by going into business on their own account. That same local government survey found that 82% of councils are considering commercialising services, which means converting them into businesses of one sort or another. And the problem seems to be that cash-strapped local authorities rarely possess the expertise or the experience to make a success of ventures of that sort.
You can't turn all council services into commercial ventures, obviously. It's hard to commercialise care for the elderly or this sort of thing.
Well, the problem you're going to get is that councils may rely on investments which may intrinsically be speculative, such as shopping centres or running your own IT company or car parks to fund things like care for the elderly and children's services, things which need a very steady stream of income and which shouldn't be vulnerable to the ups and downs of the market. There are numerous examples, but in the recent issue, we talked about Kingsland and West Norfolk Council, which over the past 4 years or so sank nearly £5 million into building a King's Lynn Innovation Centre. And they appear to have lost that £5 million with nothing really to show for it. The money was invested via a local enterprise agency in loans and grants. And the loans were meant to be paid back by November last year. But unfortunately, the enterprise agency NWES has run out of cash, and so the council's millions out of pocket, and they've had to take back the building.
And obviously, that is money that now won't be going into local services.
No. Another favourite model is IT services, because all councils have or have had IT departments, and they think, well, if we can merge or do it with somebody else, we set up a business. And a few years ago, two councils in Cheshire West and Cheshire East councils, both Tory at the time, they set up a jointly owned company called Cosocius, Cosocius, to run IT and HR services for both councils. And they thought they'd save money by sharing the resources and they'd make money by selling their marvellous expertise to other councils and to other public bodies. And unfortunately, after 18 months of operations, they'd got precisely zero outside contracts and had notched up operating losses of £1 million and a pension deficit of £8.5 million. And so in 2016, it was all taken back in-house. Again, complete flop. And the big daddy of all failed council IT schemes was called Southwest One, which died a death in 2017. And as long ago as 2008, the Eye pointed out it might not be a particularly terrific value for money. It was Somerset County Council, Taunton Deanborough Council, Avon and Somerset Police, and they joined together with IBM, the tech giant, to pool what they call back office functions. And it was going to save millions and millions and make a fantastic profit because they would sell this marvellous expertise around the Southwest and who knows where else. And the local Tory MP for Bridgewater, Ian Little Granger, didn't think much of it. And he told MPs in Parliament, so it's privileged, that it was half-baked and stupid idea, a mad, corrupt, barking scheme. And it's all fallen apart. And everybody's pulled out, and the estimated total losses, which eventually fall on the taxpayer, have been £70 million. Cool.
That's an enormous amount of money.
Hmm.
Is it just that councils are looking at what they've got? So, for example, all councils have IT departments. They all have these services that they provide, and they're thinking, well, this is what we've got, so this is what we'll be able to monetize, perhaps without appreciating that there are also other people out there who are monetizing it already and might be doing it better.
Might possibly have more experience and might be able to do it a little bit better, yes.
Yeah.
A case in point, there's a bit of a craze at the moment for councils to either set up or operate energy companies, because everybody hates the big energy companies at the moment, and people want to invest in green energy and smaller energy companies and so on. And unfortunately, anyone who's looked at the news recently will have noticed that a lot of small energy companies are going out of business. They're going out of business all over the place. Edinburgh Council had its own not-for-profit supplier called Our Power, which recently went under, owing the Scottish Government £9.5 million, reports our colleague Old Sparky. And that, they had farmed that out to other councils who had sold it to the people under their own names. So Hartlepool Council, Bath Council, they'd used their branding for people to sign up for this. And I think it's very much in the mould of the IT companies. In, oh, energy company, easy, you know, we can, and it's not for profit, so and we're not evil.
That'll save money, of course.
Yes, it's a breeze, but unless you've got the experience and the expertise and the deep knowledge, these things are not, and energy is a very, very tough market. It's not an easy thing to breeze into.
People probably also think local energy company, that sounds good, because it's probably going to be Hartlepool coal that we're burning, this kind of thing.
There's Nottingham City Council have their own energy company called Robin Hood Energy.
Okay, very nice.
You know, nifty original title. And they supply energy to local authorities such as Derby, Doncaster, Islington, Leicester, Leeds, Liverpool, I think. Now, they're still going, but Nottingham City Council is having to pedal hard to keep them going. They cancelled £7.5 million debt a year ago. They gave them another £5.5 million loan in November. They've agreed to underwrite various liabilities it has. And, it's going to be embarrassing for all concerned.
It's a curious marriage between these two things, isn't it? You know, the local councils and a money-making enterprise, because we assume that councils are there to receive money from the people living in their areas, and then they spend it on those people.
Awfully good at that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing. I have a lot of sympathy with the dilemmas they face about funding. But there are reasons why. You know, if British Gas is big and Sainsbury's are big and various property companies are big. You know, because they've accumulated years of experience of doing these things, and I think you know that. You feel you can just jump in and, oh, this is easy. Making money isn't very easy.
Well, you mentioned property just now. There's another element of this trend, which is about shopping centres.
Yeah, there's a bit of a craze at the moment. In December, the BBC reported, had a look at this issue, and they reported that local councils have spent more than £800 million on purchasing shopping centres in the UK over the last 3 years. I think since 2016, councils had bought 26 shopping malls between them, 10 of them just last year. One might, again, if one had been following the news, one might conclude that there is a reason why a lot of clapped-out shopping centres are on the market and why they're going bust. And Wigan Council last year bought a shopping centre for £8 million, more than 90% less than it was worth in 2006. when it was worth £83 million. Now, you know, that might sound like a bargain, but, you know, there are reasons. There are reasons for this. So yeah. Good luck to them if they can turn that round or turn a profit by doing something else on it. Bolton Council is another one that has spent a lot of money on shopping centres, and Surrey Heath Council and the Chartered Institute of Public Finance and Accountancy says that councils are taking a great risk here with exposing public funds to what they call unnecessary or unquantified risk. And it's that same thing again. You want a steady stream of income to run your services, and buying an old shopping centre isn't necessarily it.
You mentioned that the Taunton IT operation, that was set up before, you know, the big wave of austerity hit, as it were. But is most of this driven by cuts to council's funding?
Well, councillors and council officers have been moaning about cuts to local council funding for a very long time, 20 years or more. I mean, as long as I've been doing Rotten Boroughs, it's been an issue. The previous craze was outsourcing. So instead of running your IT or your council tax or your bins or almost anything you can think of yourself, you pay an outside company to do it. And councillors, we've written about huge contracts, places like Birmingham, Liverpool and Barnet, and they get involved with companies like Capita or Crapita, as we proudly named it. These things didn't always work out well because there were hidden costs, and these outsourcing companies tended to have much better lawyers than the councils, who were able to write very good contracts, and which, surprise, were not always to the benefit of the local councils. So outsourcing, it's either all been done or it's gone out of fashion now. They really are scraping the barrel. I mean, they're desperately, desperately trying to find out ways of making more money.
So, now we've got to the bottom of the barrel, what's the answer?
You bastard.
I said I wouldn't ask Tim this. I have done now. Come on then, how do we solve it?
Well, it's easy for me to sit at my imperial typewriter and criticise, but they can't go on like this. I mean, anyone in local government would say to you, Labour, Tory, it's not a party political thing. They would all say, you know, we really can't go on like this. And I think there has to be a fundamental reform of how local government is financed. And I think that has to, you know, start with the central government. They've got to restore some of these financial cuts that they've made. And, you know, maybe we all have to pay more for some of the services that we want. I mean, council tax is going up by nearly 5% this year for just about everybody. And maybe we have to get used to that. But chopping and scraping and shaving and selling off the family silver is not going to do it in the long run. And I don't think trying to turn yourself into a business is going to do it either.
Tim Minogue. And don't forget, if you want to read more accounts of the extremely entertaining goings-on at local government up and down the country, including a council somewhere near you, it's all in Rotten Boroughs, which is in the magazine every fortnight. And finally, banging on, you may have noticed, if you're a reader of the magazine, that Private Eye covers stories stretching back years and in some cases even decades. Whether it's the deaths of military recruits at Deep Cut, or the Tainted Blood scandal, or the Lockerbie bombing, or tax avoidance, or PFI, there are certain stories that crop up and evolve over a period of many, many years in the magazine. You might wonder why we do this and whether it has any benefit. Well, to answer that question, I spoke to one of the Eye's investigative reporters, Heather Mills, and I started off by asking her, why do we bang on so much?
Wouldn't it be nice if we wrote about something that we felt was wrong once and then it was all miraculously put right? But no, I mean, sadly and tragically, these things go on and on and on. And the contaminated blood scandal is probably a really good example of that.
So the tainted blood scandal concerns the hundreds and I think maybe even thousands given in NHS hospitals blood that had been imported and had a host of diseases in, including hepatitis or HIV,
yeah.
Many of whom have now died.
Yeah, the contaminated blood scandal was mainly haemophiliacs who were given contaminated blood clotting products in the 70s and 80s, about 5,000 in total, and coming up to 3,000 of those are already dead. and then thousands of others, and not a complete known number, of transfusion victims who were given contaminated blood, you know, through hospital procedures.
And you've been writing about this story for many years now.
Yeah.
And does it keep developing? Does it keep throwing up new things that need to be written about?
Yes, all the time. And sadly, some things that may have improved as more and more campaigns have got together to put pressure on the government. This government has never paid compensation like other governments have, proper compensation. They've always denied any kind of liability, and they've made sort of compassion payments and things like that. But they've never been enough for the sick people to live on, or indeed, you know, their families, their carers, their spouses, many of whom have given up lucrative careers to look after them. And one theme we followed, you know, for many, many years is the plight of widows, actually, or partners, who are the kind of forgotten victims of this tragedy. And they're people who may have given up, you know, their jobs as teachers, nurses, all sorts of things to look after their sick partners. And back in 2009, we highlighted the case, for example, of a lady called Harriet Bullock, whose husband died of hepatitis C. And she had the horrors then of finding in his records that, you know, they'd at one stage put that he was perhaps an alcoholic because he had liver disease, when in fact he was a haemophiliac who'd been given contaminated blood. But when he died, there was no payments for her, and she was suddenly left a widow without any support. And then changes were made a little bit to the payment system. I mean, it's a meagre system, but changes were made so that the spouses, partners of those with hepatitis C would get some kind of small payment in the way that those who had HIV had, for example. So there should have been payments available. And then many years later, another fighting campaigner, a woman called Carol Grayson, who started an organisation called Haemophilia Action, who did a lot to uncover the injustice all this time. Her partner, Peter Longstaff, died of complications of HIV and hepatitis. And he found just before he died that he'd also been given blood that may have had variant CJD. And she was suddenly, after his death and money dries up, she was suddenly facing, you know, the benefit system to try and live. And she, looking after her partner for so long, had taken its toll on her mental health and her physical health. And she had to go through these dreadful processes to try and get some money to live on. Finally, having gone through the capability work tests and all the other things that we've talked about, I'm sure, on this before, you know, the benefit system, she finally won her case, but she had to go to a benefit tribunal to prove it. And then finally, you know, we thought there was going to be some payments with the very recent changes that the government have introduced in terms of their compassion payments to victims of the contaminated blood system. And there's supposed to have been a £10,000 lump sum and funeral costs paid to all partners' spouses on the death of their partner from contaminated blood.
Ian Hislop is also one of the principal exponents of the magazine's Banging On methodology. Here he is explaining exactly what it is about Private Eye which makes it so suitable for this kind of campaigning.
Unlike a lot of dailies or a lot of weeklies, we can rely on our readers to put up with us covering the same thing at enormous length for years and years, partly because we try and make it interesting, but partly because we have the leisure is perhaps the wrong word, to go back and do it again, partly because it's a decision, so that this will be wrapped up with, you know, plenty of new features and plenty of jokes and plenty of things that I hope are entertaining. But also, if the Birmingham Six are still in the news and we're still covering that story, then we'll still go on doing it. And again, it's sort of being boring, maybe one of our strengths. That's an odd thing to say, but I look at some of the stories we've done and I think, well, are we really going to do this again? And then I think, well, yeah, we are. I mean, Heather's now going back to court for the latest deep cut inquest. And again, I mean, that will be equally revelatory, but how many investigations, how many inquests have there been until we get nearer the truth?
Do you find it disheartening writing about these examples of injustice which keep happening?
Yes, totally dispiriting. Yes, it's extraordinary, actually. Sadly, some of the things you thought were getting better are not. You know, we were almost going back in time. And I guess austerity is a factor in a lot of that.
Another thing you've written about for many years is the story of the deaths at Deep Cut, the Deep Cut barracks. Some people might say to you, these deaths all happened 20 years ago. Why are they relevant now? What good can come of writing about them now?
Relevant for all sorts of reasons. The families of those young soldiers who died at Deep Cut barracks have never got the truth behind what happened. As we talked about before, all the evidence was destroyed. You know, they were dismissed as suicides. And all the horrors of the Deep Cut barracks that we now know about, the bullying, the abuse, again, lack of resources, lack of staffing, have all come about because these families have fought for and finally got proper inquests into their deaths. The problem with it has been that, you know, memories have faded after 21 years. But we are getting, you know, there are results coming back. And, for example, one of the things that came out of the Sean Benton's death very recently, of course, is that the army decided it as a direct result of that. Sean Benton's case was the one that highlighted severe abuse and bullying at that camp, was that army recruits are now being told that they can take their complaints straight to civilian police and not go up through the chain of command. Because one of the things that was identified time and time again is that people didn't complain because of fear of repercussion. That potentially is still going to be a problem, of course, if the army then potentially, if it got to learn that you'd gone to the police, those repercussions could still happen. But it is a step in the right direction.
Is it ever depressing just how much these stories need to be written over the years?
No, I always find sort of long term it's quite inspiring. I mean, I love Richard Brooks, for example. I love the idea that, you know, he decided that the amount of tax large companies pay was something that really annoyed him alone in his bedroom. And after 10 years of writing about it, you know, it hits the national agenda. Then it hits the international agenda. Nowadays, it seems to be given that one of the things we have to do in life is make people pay tax. You know, even some of those sort of Silicon Valley billionaires, very old-fashioned to me, have noticed that, you know, a little bit of philanthropy on its own may not be as good as actually paying your taxes. So that story, I mean, it's a good decade to get going. You look at the PFI, for example, the Private Finance Initiative. Again, I think it's about two and a bit decades, many Tory and many Labour governments, before there is now a consensus that the public taking the risk and private firms taking the profit is not a great model. So, yeah, we do repeat ourselves endlessly, but I do think it comes good. It's not only in the business field, in the phone tapping story, for example. Adam, I've no idea how often he wrote about this. I mean, he even got commended by Lord Leveson, who said, you know, the only account that I actually recognise in the papers is the one in Private Eye, which is quite a bizarre tribute from a man looking into press standards. But right from the, you know, the Sun, right through the News of the World, then into the Mirror, we just keep on doing this.
I mean, there are stories in the last few issues about phone hacking payouts and the Sun having to set aside money and whether it needs more or less and this kind of thing.
Yes, it doesn't stop. I mean, I picked up the newspaper this morning and it says military housing, really not very good. And I thought, when did we first start saying selling off military housing and having it outsourced is a really terrible idea? And I can't even remember which decade it was. But, you know, we'll be back to it because that's what we do.
Is there a sense in which it's important to cover these stories, partly because government is very big and slow-moving, and you're going to have to follow these stories for years to see what happens?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And merely recording something's happened in this sector isn't really enough. You have to say, well, why did it happen, and what's going to happen next, and is it going to keep happening? For example, Jane writes about this extraordinary number of abandoned listed buildings that somehow just burn down. Or go on fire, as they call it in the business. And the more of them she records, I think the more interesting it is. And you think, well, this may not be as coincidental as it looks. Or, you know, subjects that people think aren't terribly sexy, you know, pathology laboratories, which you'd think, well, we probably shouldn't outsource that because, you know, the police are sending stuff there and, you know, hospitals are sending. Perhaps it's quite important to have this there. Oh, no, 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 they've all been sold off. Who have they been sold off to? Oh, have there been problems? Yes, there have. Well, let's find out about that. You need to follow those things. And Jane's very good at that. I mean, even recently, you know, court interpreters identified problem. Problem turns up. You think it's gone away? Whoop, no, it's back again. And I think it's up to us just to keep writing it.
And I have to ask, is there an element of the good old-fashioned private eye grudge at work here?
Do you mean an element? Yes, of course there is.
That's it for this series of Page 94. If you have enjoyed listening to it, please do review it on iTunes, or even better, tell a friend to listen. We will be back again, pending editorial approval, with a new series sometime soon. Until that point, the magazine is available in all good newsagents, and subscriptions are also available. The only other thing to say is who produced this series. It was produced by Matt Hill and Rethink Audio. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.